The morning sunlight bathed the crest of the hill almost 70 feet above Kane as he stepped out of the redoubt's open doors. Grant flanked him. Both of them were covered head to toe in mag black and carried copperheads. The trail wound down and away from the vanadium doors, leading to the forest floor almost 200 feet below. Lush vegetation grew on the hillside in all directions, with tall trees bearing leaves of all sizes and shapes. From his vantage point, Kane could see the Scific Ocean little more than 2 miles away. Looking to the left and right with the binoculars, he occasionally caught glimpses of the curving coastline hooking out toward the sea. Wisps of fog still rolled in from the ocean, obscuring the distance much of the time. The trail was well worn, speaking of the number of times Ambika had put her shock troops through the area, but stubborn grass tufts poked through the uneven rock revealed by the missing topsoil. There was no sign of a vill or outpost anywhere in the vicinity. Kane took the lead, staying to the right of the trail. Grant walked nearly 20 paces behind and on the left side. The Sandcat rumbled behind, with Bridget at the wheel and Domi manning the guns. Startled birds flew from their perches in nearby trees and bushes. Following the grade of the hill, the trail snaked back and forth. Kane felt the chill of the wind blowing in from the sea against his exposed skin. The climbing sun promised a lot of warmth in the near future, but he knew it wasn't going to be anything like the fetid hell of the Utah territories.
We'd make better time if we just rode in the Sandcat.
We'd make better targets, too.
Who the hell's gonna take on a Sandcat?
Maybe a couple of bigger Sandcats?
And wouldn't you and me be in a hell of a position to take them on?
We can always outflank them. Not to mention that we're a little more mobile on foot than we are in the Cat.
Mobile for what?
Before Kane could reply, the motion detector band around his left wrist suddenly buzzed for attention.
I've got a reading.
Where?
Kane watched the motion detector as a third green dot joined the first two. He didn't know if that was all of them or not. The motion detector had a definite radius of operation.
My side, about 20 yards in.
Got them now. This close in, you know they can eyeball us just fine. Cat ought to scare them off.
Yeah, but I was hoping to stash the cat before we ran into anyone. I'm going to check this out.
I got your six.
Kane sprinted into the brush. Three startled men scattered in the forest, bursting into an all-out run. Other pockets of movement flared up on the motion detector. In the next instant, a heavy round crashed into Kane's chest, knocking him backward. The molded polycarbonate armor did its job, but the impact knocked him on his ass and promised a hell of a bruise from the blunt trauma. Kane forced himself to move, reflexes taking over. Whomever had shot him was good, or was damn lucky, snap-firing like that. Nearly prone, Kane aimed his copperhead at the running man's legs and squeezed the trigger. The 4.85mm steel-jacketed bullets chopped a short line through the ground, throwing up clods of dirt. The 15-round clip emptied rapidly, but didn't cut the man's legs out from under him. Kane shoved himself to his feet, breathing steadily in spite of the pain that held his chest in a vise. He used the tree for cover and reloaded the copperhead. Hostile gunfire raked a flurry of splinters from the tree, tearing white patches in the bark. Kane heard Grant's copperhead roar, then the gunfire ended abruptly.
Target's down. Clear?
Clear.
That was two down. His mind raced, trying to remember where he'd seen the others. He glanced at the motion detector on his wrist, noting four other targets now. He wasn't sure if that was all of them. Kane ran through the forest, keeping the snout of the copperhead pointed down ahead of him. The man he'd shot in the legs tried to get back up. His outflung hand grabbed his weapon, a Dragunov sniper. Kane triggered a three-round burst that smashed through the man's forearm. The man dropped the rifle, staring at Kane. He was not much above 5.5 feet tall and of a slight build. Asian features held a mixture of hate and fear. Gold earrings dangled from both ears, and tattoos marred his skin, including his face and neck. He wore loose-fitting, homespun clothing. Kane kept the copperhead trained on the man.
Do you speak English?
Fuck you!
Kane's mag-trained battle ego asserted itself as Kane squeezed the copperhead's trigger. A tri-burst broke the man's head, splashing brain matter on the tree behind him. Kane was in motion before the corpse hit the ground. The Sandcat burst through the forest to his right, knocking down all trees less than a hand's breadth in thickness. The treads cleaved through the dark earth, turning up roots and stones in their wake.
Damn it, Baptiste! What the hell do you think you're doing?
Backing you up!
Grant and I can handle this.
Kane sprinted, checking the motion detector to track his quarry. Keeping his directions in mind, he knew they were headed toward the coastline. He guessed they were now less than a half mile away from the ocean.
If we couldn't, we'd have dropped back to the cat.
No one mentioned it to us.
Baptiste powered the Sandcat on, knocking down more trees and tearing underbrush out of the way with the FAV's armored hull. Kane glanced back at the path of destruction left by the Sandcat.
Shit. The trail you're leaving, Baptiste, is gonna be hard not to notice.
We can always go back to the redoubt and leave. I thought you would appreciate the help. The Sandcat's onboard sensors indicated at least a dozen men in the forest.
Kane gave up the argument and ran on, any hope of a covert op completely blown. As the land fell more toward the ocean, the grade grew more treacherous. He kept his arms folded across his chest, right arm over the copperhead, and used his armored elbows and shoulders to knock through trees. The forest thinned toward the coastline, finally ending at a rock and black sand beach that stretched inland 20 or 30 yards. The pale green of the Pacific Ocean splashed against the beach in 2-foot-high breakers. Farther out, the sea seemed more calm, and the sea green held darker patches. Two ships sat at anchor off the coastline. One of them was an ancient, mast-rigged cargo freighter that looked to have been around before the nuke cost. The sails were struck, folded, and tied to the three masts. A bowsprit pointed at the beach while it rocked sedately on the waves. The other ship drew Kane's eye instantly. It seemed all arches and angles, and the three sails weren't furled so much as they were let down like window blinds. The wood was finished in a deep cherry red, cut with narrow black lines. It gleamed in the morning sun, looking like a bird that had settled into the water and waited to take wing again. A puff of smoke rose from the red ship's side facing him. A moment later, a cannon round hammered the beach less than 30 feet from where he'd emerged from the tree line. A tall tree cracked and folded like a jackknife, the branches slapping into the beach, sending rock and sand flying.
Damn! Bastards must have had radios on them.
Kane silently agreed, then cursed himself for not checking the body. Movement from one of the big rocks, shoving up from the beach, drew his attention. He brought the copperhead into line just as the Asian man's head appeared above his rifle less than 10 feet away. The man fired rapidly, squeezing off 4 shots before Kane's tri-burst tore his face away. The body staggered back, slumping onto the wet beach. Gazing behind the stand of a dozen rocks that ranged from a yard high to over a man's height, Kane spotted the small motorboat wedged onto the beach. 4 men, fighting the tide and one another, struggled to push the boat back out into the water. The ship's cannon put 2 more rounds onto the beach closer to Kane's position. He ran for the rocks, angling toward the men pushing the motorboat. Grant moved in from the other side, striding over a body sprawled out in front of him. Another armed man leaned out from one of the rocks. Kane snap-fired a pair of rounds that left white scars against the rock, but succeeded only in chasing the gunner behind cover. Still on the move, Kane closed on the man's position. When the enemy leaned out again, Kane put a round through his eye, ripping away half of his face in an explosion of red mist. Moving among the rocks, Kane moved the copperhead to his left hand and snapped the sin eater out, opting for its shorter length among the crowded rocks. Rounds drummed a deadly tattoo against the polycarbonate armor over his left side, but didn't penetrate. Kane spun, bringing the sin eater up automatically. He targeted the man hardly more than an arm's reach away and put 3 9mm rounds through the man's chest, blowing him back. In the next instant, the world dissolved into a maelstrom of whirling, blinding sand as another cannonball slammed into the ground near him. When he could see again, the air still hazy with the dry dust of the beach, he spotted the crater between the stand of rocks and the motorboat.
Kane!
Here!
Kane moved through the rocks, finding another man and shooting him down before the guy could raise his weapon. Farther down the beach, the Sandcat roared through the forest line, pushing down trees. The left tread locked, and the FAV wheeled around, slewing wide as Bridget fought the controls. Sand and rock spewed out from behind it.
Lock onto that damn red ship. Those machine guns will reach that far. Aim at the waterline.
Kane reloaded, and he and Grant moved in tandem, covering each other as they took on the 4 men who'd been pushing the motorboat.
Keep the boat in one piece.
You going into the sailing business?
That cargo ship out there looks big enough to take the Sandcat onto it. We get mobile again, maybe we can leave the Sandcat somewhere else. Hell, we might need it somewhere else for that matter.
Agreed.
Kane saw the flurry of activity aboard the red ship. The sails ran up the 3 masts, unfolding like accordions. Red material with black ribbing caught the wind, belling out.
Ready?
Let's go.
Kane spun and pushed both weapons before him. He fired first with the copperhead, knocking down the 2 men on the right of the motorboat. Only one of them survived, and he chopped the man down with a single round from the Sin Eater. Grant finished both of his targets at the same time. Out at sea, the red ship was in full flight, the rectangular sails curved with the wind's breath, pushing away from shore. The crew of the other ship struggled to get their sails up as well, but weren't as crisp or clean in their efforts.
Baptiste, keep us covered. We're going to try to take the cargo ship.
Why?
To give us more options.
Kane nodded at Grant, and they took hold of the motorboat. Even with both of them, pushing the boat out into the water was hard. It left a deep gouge in the wet sand as they shoved it backward.
Yeah. Get in and fire it up.
Kane kept pushing. With the water taking some of the boat's weight, it was easier going. Grant heaved himself over the side and made his way to the back. Grant pushed the motor's starter button a few times. Kane hauled himself over the boat's side. Powering the boat, Grant brought it around with a little hesitation. Though both of them had extensive training with the Deathbirds and Sandcats, neither had spent very much time in the river patrol boats the MagDivision maintained. Usually, if any roamers or outlanders threatened Cobaltville on the Kanab River, they were summarily blown out of the water by the armored gun emplacements.
Handles kind of like a Deathbird. A really slow, fucking ungainly Deathbird.
Kane nodded. Whitecaps burst against the outboard's pointed nose, and some of the overspill splashed aboard. Only one of the cargo ship's sails was in place. The ship rocked dangerously from side to side. The sail twisted in the wrong direction as it fought the anchor. In the distance, the red ship was fast disappearing over the horizon.
You think he's gonna get friends, or just gone for good?
I don't know, but I'm not planning on us being around long enough to find out.
As they neared the cargo ship, small arms fire rumbled from the side. Bullets hammered the outboard's wooden hull, but the construction was solid enough that they didn't penetrate.
They're not as heavily armed, and they're not all Asian.
He spotted only a half dozen men aboard who showed Asian heritage. The others appeared to be a mix of whites, blacks, and Hispanics, men and women. They were unarmed, and the Asians kept them at a distance. Even as Kane watched, members of the crew rebelled. Two of the Asians were dragged down to the deck. Blades flashed.
Grant, I see.
The mutiny aboard the ship continued, but the crew wasn't strong enough to stand against the Asians. Mercilessly, the Asians banded together near the bow and started shooting the crew. Reluctantly, the crew gave ground. The insurrection was on the verge of being contained through sheer attrition.
Get us over to the anchor.
Grant swooped in with the outboard, easily reaching the stranded ship, dancing at the end of its anchor line. Kane peered up at the side of the ship, hung the copperhead by its shoulder strap, and threw himself at the line. He caught the thick hawser, then started pulling himself up.
Right behind you.
Kane concentrated on pulling himself up, his arms straining with the effort, as well as managing a wet rope. In long seconds, his breath rasping inside his helmet, he reached up and grabbed the edge of the bow. He pulled himself up, peering over the edge. Seven Asians took cover in the bow. Kane caught the railing and pulled himself up. Two of the Asians spotted him, positioned for a crossfire across the deck. They turned their weapons toward him. Kane threw himself over the railing, rolling and coming up on one knee as he reached for the copperhead hanging at his side. He fired from mid-crouch, chewing through the two men with the 4.85mm rounds. The two Asian gunners stumbled back as the bullets smashed through their chests. One of them went over the bow railing. Dropping the copperhead to hang by its shoulder sling, Kane flexed his wrist muscles. The Sin Eater popped out, slamming into his palm. Grant was at his side, his own copperhead roaring sudden death. Bullets struck Kane as he fired the Sin Eater dry. He stood his ground, the way he'd been trained, pulling out a clip to reload his weapon. One of the Asians broke ranks unexpectedly, charging at Kane. The man's weapon blazed in his hands, and the line of bullets hammered at Kane's chest, rising toward his unprotected throat and chin.
Oh, fuck!
Kane threw himself to one side. The extra magazine he'd been about to load into the Sin Eater skittered from his hands. The man's weapon emptied, but he still raced at Kane.
I'm out.
Grant tried to reload his own weapons as two surviving gunners fired at him. Kane retracted his Sin Eater and grabbed his combat knife from his boot sheath, keeping the blade's edge pointing forward, laying it along his forearm. The man raised his empty assault rifle in front of his chest like a club. Kane stepped forward to meet the man's rush, slamming his gloved right hand into the man's chin, knocking his head up and back. He followed the blow with his knife. The razor-edged steel bit into the man's neck, slicing through his windpipe and jugular. Recovering his balance, Kane spun in the other direction, ramming his armored elbow into the middle of the dying man's back, sending the dying man flying over the railing. Kane crossed the deck and wiped the blood from the knife on a dead man's clothes. He sheathed the knife and reloaded his weapons. Only one man remained alive, and he'd given up the fight. He ran pell-mell toward the stairs leading down from the bow to the main deck. Dispassionately, Grant locked the Sin-Eater onto the man and pumped two rounds between his shoulder blades. The corpse flew from the top of the stairs and landed on the deck in a loose heap. A man stepped from cover behind the mainmast. He was something less than 6 feet in height, thin and reddened from the sun. His bleached blonde hair was pulled back and tied with a leather thong, and his fierce goatee carried more red than blonde. Small seashells hung from his ears. He wore a sleeveless shirt and patched jeans. Kane stepped to the bow railing overhanging the main deck. The cargo ship still pitched viciously, but the crew came out of hiding and started tending to the sails.
Who's in charge of this ship?
I am. I'm Jeremiah Christensen, and this is my ship, called Sloop John B. She's a free trader in these waters, and I mean to keep her that way.
He waved his handgun meaningfully. Grant took his place beside Kane.
You people didn't look too goddamn free before we got here.
A setback. Free trading isn't without its risks. That's how a crew keeps its profits at a respectable level.
Who were these people?
You don't know?
I wouldn't ask if I did.
Tong. They were members of Wei Kiang's organization.
Baptiste, help me out here.
A tong was originally a meeting hall or place, and the term was first used in the 1880s to describe illegal Chinese activities in San Francisco.
But the history lesson, Baptiste, tell me what a damn tong is.
A criminal organization.
Pirates by any other name.
You don't know that they're any worse than those people on that ship.
Yeah, free trader does have that ring about it, doesn't it?
More of the crew had come forward to support their leader.
Who do you trade with on this island?
Christensen eyed Kane consideringly, then tucked the hand blaster inside his waistband. The crew behind him only relaxed a little.
Small Vills. They make handicrafts and foodstuffs I trade for. Some scavenge goods I know buyers will pick up.
Kane nodded toward the ocean's western horizon where the red ship had disappeared.
Raiders?
Competitors. Wei Kiang is a greedy bastard, and he's got enough ships behind him to back his play. He's probably locked up 60% or more of the free trade available in the Western Isles. Man's nearly 80 years old and still wants it all. His son is just as greedy and probably going to be worse to deal with. He's a flaming psychopath.
Kane walked the deck and eyed the crew. They weren't well armed by any standards, and the ship only had 3 cannon on rolling wheels.
Sloop John B's strength is in her speed. Those assholes hadn't caught us cutting into shore. They wouldn't have caught us.
Any chance they'll be back?
Yeah, there's a chance. And if they do, you can bet there'll be more than one ship. There's 2 things Kiang don't put up with. 1's letting anybody get the better of him in a deal or a fight. 2's losing any of his ships. Despite the way the land around here has come back after the nuke cost, timber's a precious commodity.
How long are you going to be here?
On Columbine? I don't know. Got a couple of deals set up on the south side of the island I need to tend to, and we're out of here.
We're going with you.
You're gonna have to dicker over the passage fare.
Kane kicked the dead man at his feet.
We're paid in full, and if you don't see it that way, I'll put you ashore and take any men who don't want to be here when those Tong get back.
The ship's captain made a face, but he didn't argue. Kane stood beside Christensen at the big wheel as the ship made her way around the southern end of Columbine Island. They had pulled into port at a small vill that, nevertheless, had a pier strong enough to get the Sandcat aboard. The people were stranger than Kane had seen in a vill. Christensen said they belonged to an old faith called Nude Hists that believed that separating their skin from the sun's rays would kill them. Kane had never seen so many naked, sunburned, but happy people in one spot in his life. Christensen reckoned that they were walking tumor farms and triple stoop beside, but they did fair business. While the crew had done their trading, Kane, Grant, Bridget, and Domi managed to situate the FAV. The Sandcat now sat in the middle of the main deck, tied down with thick hawsers and with its tracks locked. It wasn't going anywhere. Wasn't even shifting with the roll and pitch of the cargo ship. Christensen hadn't appeared happy about the thought of bringing the vehicle along, but Kane hadn't given him any choice. As soon as business was concluded, they'd set back out to sea. Kane surveyed the thick growth of forest that started just on the other side of the beach.
I thought this place was nuked to hell during Skydark.
You haven't seen the Blight Belt.
Blight Belt?
There's a bunch of islands out here that carry hot rad. Stuck up out of the water like stone-boiled blisters. Nothing grows on them, and sea creatures getting too close to them for too long wash up on the shores. They're part of the old land masses that were here.
Kane looked at Columbine Island.
What about this?
That's the miracle of tectonics, they tell me. Same as the islands that were made from volcanoes erupting along the bottom of the ocean thousands and thousands of years ago. What caused most of California to fall off into the Pacific Ocean was two tectonic plates that overlapped right here. The Earthshaker bombs opened those plates right up and let the sea in. Sometime after the new cost, those plates opened again, and volcanoes spewed new islands out into the sea. The soil was scraped up from the ocean bed, so it's fertile.
Where did the people come from?
Hell, people came from everywhere. A lot of them were from villes scattered up and down the coast. Some of them were mariner families who survived on trading and scavenging. Wei Qiang and the Tong came over with his father. And a meaner, a bloodier bastard there ain't been yet.
Came over from where?
China. His father had set up a trading op in China that stretched up to Russia. His family and the families of anybody who worked with him were pretty much living on boats like the one you saw. Some of them have been around hundreds of years, even before the new cost.
What brought them over here if things were going so well over there?
Greed must run naturally in Qiang's family. The way I hear it, the old man near about got himself whacked for trying to take over somebody else's action. He had more balls than bullets. So he ended up over here. If it hadn't been for Ambika, that old bastard would have already owned the Western Isles.
Where does Ambika fit into this?
How do you know her?
I don't know her, but I've heard of her.
Well, they call her the Lioness of the Isles, and I don't know her either. Very few people do. She's got an island fortress southwest of here that's more heavily armored and armed than anything the Tong Masters have put together.
Do you do any trading with her?
Not there. Nobody goes there, except by invitation. Or if she's got a grudge she wants to work on. Come on, I'm hungry.
Christensen walked back to mid-deck, where some of the new trade goods were still stacked. Kane followed, nodding to Grant and Bridget, who were already there. Christensen had taken on fresh water, a valuable commodity, and fresh fruit and vegetables, as well as preserved meat the islanders had traded. As Kane, Grant, and Bridget sampled the food, Kane glanced at their host.
Where do you think Ambika came from?
I figure she came through the redoubt on Columbine Island, but some think she came from heaven, or the pits of hell.
You deal with her?
Yeah, deal with Qiang on occasion, too. I'm gonna give him an earful over his people trying to pick off my ship this morning, but it won't do any good.
Why?
Fucker, tell me it was SOG did it.
SOG?
Some other guy. It's one of his typical defenses. When Ambika established herself on her island about 10 years ago, he tried raiding some of her war parties. Got a couple of them, too. She did not put up with that shit.
What did she do?
The lioness walked into Daija Lu, the biggest Gaudian autarkic, and when she
What's
got...
autarkic? I know one of the literal translations of the word means free.
Yeah, basically, that's it. With all the commerce and conflicting trade groups in the islands, some place had to be set up where trading could be done without interference. It's an island by itself located in the middle of the main island groups in the area. All the trading that takes place there goes on without any of the trading groups horning in.
There has to be somebody who makes sure the place stays free.
It's a sec committee put together by all the islands, but it's generally just a collection of some of the fightin'est men in the islands.
Nobody can buy them off?
Nobody can pay that high. The reason they took that post? Graft. You get a cut of every deal that goes through autarkic.
Doesn't sound so free that way.
Yeah, the deal's a hell of a lot better than working for somebody. Of course, if you're shorting somebody else, you run that risk. And if you're shipping solo, like me, you run the risk of what nearly happened today. Still, I like calling my own shots.
Ambika, what about her wars with Qiang?
Like I said, the lioness walked into the Daija Lu and braced Qiang in front of his own men. Told him one of his ship's captains had busted one of her ships, took the goods off it, and sunk the ship. It's one thing to steal somebody's goods, but it's another to put a ship down. Ships are too goddamn hard to come by. She walked into the Daija Lu, pulled out that fucking hand cannon she carries, and chilled one of the Tong captains at Qiang's own table.
Woman's brassy. What did Qiang do?
Oh, hell, he sat there. Maybe he'd have tried something, or one of his lieutenants would have. She put that on ice straight away. Before the son of a bitch she shot could fall out of his chair, she tossed an explode pack on the table, already wired for the big boom. Then she took out a remote detonator with two switches on it. She flicked one of them. Out in the harbor, you could hear the series of explosions, one right after another, like auto fire. When it stopped, she looked at Kiang and told him that was two of his ships sinking out in the harbor. And it was. She told him any time he attacked one of her ships, she'd take two of his, and two ships' captains. And she put that big pistol on Kiang and told him to pick a captain. He did. And she chilled that guy, too, without even blinking an eye. And she turned and walked away.
And they fucking let her? With that explo pack on the table?
Well, Kiang is triple greedy, but he's not triple stupid. When Ambika was standing there, Wei Kiang reached out and took that explo pack in one hand, rolled it over his fingers as easy as you please, and talked with her the whole time.
Letting her know she didn't dare chill him either.
Yeah, and that's the way it's been ever since. The people on these islands are afraid if anything does stir up between Ambika and Kiang that they can't put down, it'll spill over onto all of the islands and chill a lot of people.
How many people know about the redoubt back on Columbine Island?
Oh, nearly everybody. Most folks knew about it before Ambika showed up. But after she did, everybody knew. She keeps a small navy on hand just for transporting those assault vehicles of hers. That's another reason Kiang doesn't want to mess with her. He's got a few wags, but nothing like what Ambika's got.
Where does she get them?
I don't know. As far as anybody can remember, she's always had them. Just like that place she has in the Isles of the Lioness.
That's what she calls it?
She doesn't call it anything. That's what everybody else calls it. And Beka doesn't tell anybody her business. But the place on the Isles of the Lioness is another redoubt. Until she came along, that place was locked up tighter than a constipated virgin.
You got a map of these islands?
Sure.
I want to see it.
Kane and Bridget studied the meticulously rendered map of the Western Isles down in the captain's quarters. From looking at the number of islands scattered around on it, Kane doubted every one of the islands was shown, but it showed a lot of them.
Do you think we have a chance of recruiting Ambika? From what we've heard this morning, she seems to be very independent-minded.
She's already going up against Baron Cobalt and taking ore from the mines. There's no way we're going to recruit her.
Why not? Lakesh might want to.
If he's thinking that way, he's fooling himself. Ambika is not going to play second banana on anybody's team. She's a first stringer all the way.
Kane traced the route Christensen had told him they were taking, noting the distance to Autarkic from Columbine Island. The ship's captain expected to arrive there in 2 days' time.
You like that about her, don't you?
Hell, Baptiste, I don't even know her.
Perhaps not yet, but you like how she handles herself. I saw your eyes when Christensen was telling us the story about Ambika's confrontation with Kiang.
It was a ballsy move. I respect it. Like has nothing to do with it.
She's a warrior, Kane. Like you.
I understand why she's doing what she's doing, Baptiste. That doesn't mean we're anything alike.
In the mags, you were taught to terminate as an example. The same way Ambika did those people in Utah.
Is this about her or about me, Baptiste?
She looked at him for a long moment, her jade gaze thoughtful.
I don't know.
Then she turned and left him, standing there. Later, Kane and Grant sat in the Sandcat to consider strategy. Kane glanced through the ob slit and looked to the stern, where Domi kept an eye on Christensen. Bridget sat at the electronics console near them, keeping her own counsel. He wished she understood more of his thinking, and the importance of a liaison between Ambika and Cerberus. The Lioness's resources could add a lot to any force rebelling against the baronies. However, there still remained the question of where Ambika came from and what her intentions were.
Christensen says we'll make Autarkic sometime late tomorrow morning. Have you figured out where we're going from there?
If Ambika's as good as I think she is, she'll have spies on Autarkic. All we'll have to do is let it be known that we're looking for her. She'll come to us. Or have someone come to us. For now, I think it's time we talked with Lakesh again.
Kane glanced wordlessly at Bridget, who contacted Cerberus without comment.
Friend Kane.
Yeah, it's us. We're not dead yet, and we're calling to get the truth out of you, old man, so no games, okay?
I must remonstrate with you for your accusations.
Remonstrate all you want to, old man. The fact of the matter is that you've been holding back information from us.
Ask me whatever you wish, friend Kane, and I shall endeavor to free you from your doubts.
What about Ambika, Lakesh? You said you didn't know she was involved when you sent us in, but you know about her, don't you?
I'm afraid, dearest Bridget, that I must reiterate the presentation I made in my defense earlier. I don't know this Ambika person.
Oh, really? Then tell me about Project Excalibur's Ambika folder, Conception Beowulf.
Only silence came from the other end of the connection. Kane started to think Lakesh had broken the comlink.
The truth, Lakesh. I tapped into those files myself and only got a partial download. You blocked me from the rest of them.
As you know, over Project Excalibur dealt almost exclusively with genetic manipulation. A geneticist named Will Longley intended to create a more perfect human. He intended to eradicate illness and genetic imperfections and improve upon the original template.
Ambika?
I didn't know about Ambika, friend Kane. It was just a name Longley assigned to his project.
Ambika is the name of a mythological Hindu battle goddess. In her pantheon, she was one of the most powerful entities. She guided warriors in battle, delivered victories, and rewarded bravery. She was also a warrior herself. The legends I read suggested that she declared she'd never take any man to bed that hadn't beaten her in battle.
Now there's a strong case of performance anxiety.
Grant!
Sorry.
The references I pulled up on the comp also stated that Ambika could turn herself into Kali, one of the most feared goddesses in the Hindu religion. A group of cold heart chillers, called Thuggees, selected her as their chosen goddess and committed atrocious crimes in her name.
She isn't a goddess, Baptiste.
No, she isn't. She's just a woman.
Is Ambika human?
Human? Your definition of human, dearest Bridget, or mine? What yardstick will you prop her against to determine that?
She's cold, Lakesh. Life doesn't appear to mean much to her.
That's your judgment, Baptiste. Just because she can chill someone in cold blood doesn't mean she's not human. Grant, Domi, and I can take a life the same way.
Can you, Kane? I've seen you kill when you deemed it necessary. But could you order the execution of helpless people the way Ambika did?
You don't know everything I've done, Baptiste.
Friend Kane, you yet maintain an open mind about Ambika?
You mean, do I still think it's possible we could use her for our own purposes?
If you prefer to be so coarse, yes. Though I view the opportunity as mutually beneficial. She will, I trust, use us as much as we are able to use her.
Yeah. I want to see what she's all about.
And she does have an army. We've seen it. Having her on our side would give us the chance to be proactive rather than reactive. I'm tired of being crowded into the corners by Baron Cobalt.
Right then. So we shall proceed.
The next morning, Kane stuck close to Christensen as the sloop John B. dropped anchor in the shallow port outside Autarkic. Nearly five dozen other ships were also in the anchorage. A third of them were the red lacquered ships of the Tong. Armed men remained visible on their decks. The anchorage was built around a natural spit of land that stabbed out into the ocean over shallow waters. All the docks, which were of no uniform size or shape or color scheme, appeared busy. On the hills leading up from the docks, a variety of buildings stood against a backdrop of young trees. Most of them were single-level structures, but there were some two-story structures as well. One of the buildings, poised nearly in the heart of the ville, even stood four stories tall. Nearly all of the structures were made from second-hand materials. The tallest building, like a few of the others, was crafted of mortised stone.
Where do the labor groups come from?
Other villes on the island. Some of them even come in from outlying islands. In the past, other islands tried to set themselves up as trading posts, but they couldn't field the sec forces Autarkic had to offer. Also, Alan Spelling organized the local labor groups enough to guarantee the competition wasn't going to stay.
How?
Though it couldn't be proved, or maybe nobody wanted to prove it, Spelling and his people burned out the docks on other islands. Once they were burned out and knew they weren't going to get the support they thought they would, they didn't try again.
Christensen walked away to leave last-minute instructions with his first mate. Kane watched the small outboard boat being lowered over the side before sweeping his companions with his gaze.
I don't want to leave the cat unguarded, even though we've got Christensen with us. Grant and I will go into Autarkic. We should be back in a few hours.
I don't like that. You and Grant have the same view of Ambika. I'd rather go.
We don't even know if she's here.
Yes, we do. Those are her ships.
She pointed at a cluster of transport ships much larger than the Sloop John V. The flags on the ships bore the profile of a big snarling lioness with its ears flattened against its yellow-gold head on a field of light blue and white split diagonally. Kane studied them for a moment, easily spotting the tarp-covered wags on their decks. The ships he saw didn't number enough to account for all the vehicles that had been reported in the Utah territories, so he assumed Ambika had sent some of them on.
Good. It'll save time looking for her.
He stepped into the outboard, hanging only a couple of feet below the cargo ship's railing.
You don't represent the combined interests of Cerberus.
No, but neither do you. But for now, I agree with Lakesh about finding Ambika. I can't make you stay here, Baptiste. If you want to go, go. But you're going to be leaving Domi on her own with this crew.
Grant could stay. Or you, for that matter.
No, I'm going. And if I'm going to walk into that Vill, Grant's going to cover my back. He's the only one who's had the experience in Vill surroundings to do the job right. If it comes down to it, I know he won't hesitate to chill somebody who needs chilling. Or deciding if it needs to be done. You decide what you want to do, Baptiste.
Kane signaled the deckhands to finish lowering the outboard after Christensen and Grant joined him. Before the outboard lowered out of sight of the deck, he watched Bridget turn and walk away. Anger swirled within him, directed at himself because he hadn't wanted to speak to her so harshly, and directed at her because she failed to see things the way he did. He pushed the emotion from his mind as much as he could and sat in the prow. Christensen started the outboard's engine and powered them into the sea lanes between the ships at anchor. When they docked the outboard minutes later, Christensen turned off the motor, hopped out of the craft, and tossed the mooring line to one of the dockhands. After paying the small dock fee, the ship's captain led the way up the rise to the Vill. The incline was steep enough at times that the earth had been cut into, then laced with heavy timbers that made steps. Grant and Kane had left the black mag armor in the Sandcat and opted for traveling wear that allowed them to blend into the crowd, but they'd worn the heavy mag trench coats that covered most of their bodies. Autarkic's trade moved briskly. Hardly anyone gave them a second glance. At least that was what Kane thought until he spotted a group of six Asians standing in the shade of a tarp thrown over the eastern-facing wooden walkway in front of a salvage and repair shop. A handwritten sign in the multi-paned window advertised bait and diving gear. The Asians conferred among themselves for a moment, obviously deep into decision-making. Then one of the men split off from the others. The five remaining kept their eyes on Christensen, Kane, and Grant.
They've been looking for us. Evidently, the ship you blasted made it back here just fine.
As they passed the repair shop, the five Asians drifted onto their back trail. Kane and Grant kept silent. It wouldn't do any good to brace any of the men here and now. The Asians knew the territory, and they definitely had more help that they could call on. The streets remained narrow and rutted from wag wheels and horses' hooves. Crowds of hawkers flocked out to greet the newly arrived ships. Males and females of all ages offered everything from goods to sex, accosting the sailors shamelessly. Kane and Grant both immediately attracted women and men offering sexual services.
Hey, big man. I can make you forget your own name.
Hey, baby. You like big titties?
Sure.
One, two, three.
You want some of this?
I can show you some knots you ain't never seen before.
All of them were ill-dressed, and cleanliness wasn't even an afterthought. Kane noticed his Asian followers had decreased the distance separating them.
Kane, chill them only if you have to.
Some of the nearby hawkers were making a point to seek out other targets and get clear of the immediate area.
Shit.
Christensen stepped away from Kane.
Don't go far.
Kane ducked as a knotted length of chain swooped over his head. Before coming up, he planted a hard-thrown fist into his attacker's groin. The man sprayed vomit as he violently emptied his stomach. Kane shoved him back with his other hand, taking in the four men following the first. Beyond them, the others stood watching in silence. The second man came at Kane with a camp axe, lifting it high. Kane grabbed a double fistful of the man's shirt and headbutted him. His attacker's nose broke, and blood spurted. He still tried to stay on his feet and use the axe again. Kane threw a backhand punch to the man's temple, slapping him from his feet. Kane wheeled fast and clotheslined his attacker in the throat. Grant kept moving, pulling his hands up close to his face, fists half closed. He and Kane stayed back to back. An attacker came at Kane with shimmering knives in both fists. Kane lifted an arm, depending on the Kevlar weave of the mag jacket to turn aside the blades. Even as the razored edges sawed uselessly in a double lick against the coat, he spun on his left heel, set himself, and kicked the man in the left knee, shattering it. Kane kicked the man in the face as he fell. The blow twisted the man's head to the side and knocked him unconscious, sprawling him in the street. Turning, Kane watched Grant drive two blows into his opponent's face, putting him down. The two men, who were still conscious after the attack, hobbled away, leaving their three accomplices behind. Christensen stood there, looking a touch dazed.
I thought you said security was tight on this island.
It is. You won't find anyone stealing from those ships out in the harbor, and the pilferage from the warehouses is almost non-existent. Come on, let's get going.
The gawkers moved on as the men went on their way.
So, a man walking the streets isn't safe.
Not if he can't take care of himself. For that, they charge extra. That's why most of the trading's conducted out on the ships.
What about the trading that takes place at the Dajalu?
Man only goes in there if he's got balls made of brass.
Well, clink clink, buddy.
I told you about the time I saw Ambika confront Wei Qiang. Over the years, I've been inside maybe 3-4 times. Seats inside Dajalu cost a lot of jack, too. Wei Qiang will be in there.
We're looking for Ambika.
And he's the one person on this island I can guarantee will know where she is at all times. That's only one of the things he makes his business.
He's going to generously share this information with us?
Christensen didn't hesitate as he approached the long flight of steps leading up to the Dajalu's main entrance. The double doors occupied a corner rather than one of the sides. They stood under a tall wooden canopy that sported carved wooden ducks on the frontispiece as well as on the support columns. Stained bottle green glass filled the small latticework over the generous windows. More scrollwork covered the window ledges and the shutters around them. Bullet scars marred the exterior, but none of them looked fresh.
Wei Qiang does things that amuse him. Maybe I'll tell him you're looking for Ambika and that'll raise his curiosity or spur his lust for amusement. You two guys definitely don't come across as a fun time. Kang's no stoop. He'll figure that out straight away. Maybe he'll put you with her just to see what happens.
Kane stayed to Christensen's right and a half step behind as he pushed through the double doors and went inside. Grant stayed to the left and a little farther back. Even after seeing the commanding presence the Dajalu had in the ville, Kane still wasn't quite prepared for the elegance that existed inside the place. Craftsmen who cared about their work had put the interior together, using a combination of dark, hand-rubbed woods, 4-inch tiles of white rock, and the bottle-green glass. Small round tables filled the middle of the immense room's floor, flanked on three sides by high booths that permitted privacy. White curtains with bottle-green glass beads and dark wood ribs hung from rods strung across the ceiling. They could be pulled to further enhance that privacy. Only a few of the tables and booths were filled. Waitstaff, dressed in dark red uniforms, worked the tables, refreshing drinks and bringing out platters of food. The sweet smell of burning incense hung in the air. Sekmen wore black uniforms, and they were just as easy to pick out. They didn't wear their blasters openly, but Kane could tell from the cut of their clothes that they had them. They were a mix of all races, all of them hard men who'd grown up looking over the sights of one blaster or another.
Eight.
Kane figured Grant had caught the two Sekmen stationed on the second floor, looking down on the first. A long and winding staircase curled up to the left, allowing a partial view of the second floor. Christensen paused only to glance around, then headed for the corner booth, which was three times the size of the other booths. The rods on the ceiling allowed curtains to be drawn to cover the large area as well, but they were open at the moment. 17 Asian men sat at the table, all of them gazing at Kane and Grant. All were young to middle-aged, except for the man who sat in the back against the wall. He was without a doubt one of the oldest men Kane had ever seen. Lit by the candles floating in a large glass vase in front of him, the old man looked leathery and reptilian. His coloration was buttery rum, and despite the fact that he was rail thin, his skin hung on him as if it were three sizes too large. He was bald, but his gray, ropey eyebrows jutted ferociously over gnarled pits of gristle that contained eyes the color and texture of ball bearings. He wore a handmade dark blue suit that gleamed from the candle's glow. Four of the men seated at the table stood immediately and formed a flesh and blood wall in front of the old man. They kept their hands folded in front of them, but their stances told Kane they were ready to move in an eye blink. Christensen didn't hesitate in his approach, but he stopped just out of arm's reach from the sect men. Kane and Grant stopped farther back and stepped apart. They kept their eyes on the men in front of them.
Kang, I want to talk to you.
It is fine, Captain. You may speak from there.
Yesterday at Columbine Island, one of your ships attacked me. Damn near took my ship.
The ball-bearing eyes swept over Kane and Grant, barely resting on Christensen.
I am sorry to hear of your troubles, but you tread on dangerous ground by implying that I am in any way to blame for your ill fortune.
I am not implying. I'm telling you flat out that I know that ship was yours.
Perhaps you mistake that ship for one of another tongue.
The hell I did.
Kane bit back his anger. What was Christensen doing baiting the Tong warlord? It didn't make sense. The old man flicked his black marble eyes at a sect guard. Smooth as oil rolling off water, the man drew a hand blaster from under his jacket. Kane moved even faster, stepping forward. He flexed his wrist and popped the Sin Eater against his palm. As his fingers closed around it, his forefinger settling against the firing stud, he grabbed the sect man's wrist and yanked it to the ceiling. The sect man's blaster went off, gouging splinters from overhead. Before anyone could move, Kane put the Sin Eater sights on Wei Kiang and stepped behind the sect man, using him as a shield. To his credit, the Chinese warlord stared down the length of the barrel without batting an eye. As if they'd planned the whole thing, Grant backed his play, disarming and holding a second sect man dead still with his Sin Eater pressed to the man's temple. One of the sect men moved slightly, getting ready to throw himself in front of Kang. Kane shifted his aim only slightly and squeezed the trigger. Kane kept his gaze locked on Kang.
No! It stops now. Next man up or moving, and I put a round between your eyes, old man.
You are that good.
Yes.
But you didn't kill my guard.
I didn't try. So far, I haven't cost you any lives other than the ones of your men on the ship that tried to take Christensen's.
You're not from this place. So I must ask myself how you came to be in this place and why.
Does it matter?
No. Because you will not leave this building alive.
Then neither of us will.
Should you succeed in killing me, I have men who will make it their life's work to track you to the ends of the earth and claim your head. And they will be quite handsomely paid for their efforts. My insurance policy. In the unlikely event that something untoward should happen to me.
If I was here to chill you, it would have already been done. You wouldn't have seen me coming, but that's not what I'm here for.
Then why are you here?
Business. Same as everybody who comes into this place.
Huh. You intrigue me. I have your word that you won't try to harm me.
You're that trusting?
With you, perhaps. We'll see. While you're with me, you shall be even more of a target than I am.
Kane retracted the Sin Eater. Kang waved to three of the chairs on the other side of his massive table. Sekmen vacated them immediately. Christensen sat, no longer quite as belligerent. Kane sat to the right of him, both hands resting comfortably on the table.
Please release my man.
Grant released the sect man with a small push that created immediate distance between them. The sect man bowed and moved away, chastised. Reaching into a red lacquered box, Kang took out an unfiltered cigarette. He made a production of smelling it, then licked one end and stuck it into his mouth.
Do you smoke?
Kane reached into his pocket with his left hand and took out a cigar.
Yeah.
You may smoke if you wish.
Kang took one of the floating candles from the vase in front of him and lit his cigarette, then handed the candle over to Kane. Taking the candle, Kane noticed that it had been carved in the shape of a rose, delicate and many-petaled. He lit his cigar, then passed the candle to Grant.
Mr. Christensen?
A servant pushed the lacquered box over to the ship's captain. Christensen took a cigarette, then got a light from Grant. He sat meekly in his chair, his fingers trembling slightly. For all his posturing, Kane knew the man was putting up a braver front than he honestly felt.
You say you were attacked, Captain Christensen.
The way the ship looked, it had to have been one of yours.
But it wasn't. I hope you understand that.
What I understand is that if anyone makes another move on the sloop John B., someone's going to pay.
If I'm not mistaken, Christensen, I was just insulted and threatened. In my business, I can't allow that. Once word got around that I had been treated so disrespectfully, others would get the impression that anyone could treat me that way.
You might rethink this, Kang.
Oh?
There's no mistaking the ship that attacked the sloop John B. It was one of those red jobs that fill up the harbor right now. The only way you're going to hush up the story is to chill everyone on Christensen's ship.
I assure you, that wouldn't be a problem.
I didn't think that it would. I've seen people in this situation react that way. But you do have an option. You can explain to Christensen how that ship that attacked him was one taken from you by another Tong, or that some of your navy has gone rogue.
Why should I do that?
Because it would be easier than chilling all of us. I assure you that I'm not getting up from this table while I feel in any way threatened.
Exactly what is your position in this matter?
I don't have a position in this matter. I was there and gave Christensen a hand. And I'm here now working on keeping my skin together.
Kang's gaze remained stony. Then his bright ball-bearing eyes crinkled up in the wrinkled pits of gristle surrounding the sockets.
You're right, of course. Captain, if you say you were attacked by one of my ships, it must have been one that has been taken from me. I can see how such a mistake can arise.
Christensen maintained the eye contact for a moment, then glanced at Kane.
If I back his story, word's gonna get around. Other independent ships will get targeted, and they'll have the ready-made excuse that it was some rogue ship of his that did it.
Maybe, but you walked in here with this. Have you got another card to play?
Christensen shook his head in disgust. Kang smiled.
However, if more of this starts happening, other ships are going to get trigger-happy any time they see red ships around. In fact, the braver captains might be ones who take over red ships caught by themselves, certain they're rogue as well.
A sword that cuts both ways. That amuses me. Well, Christensen, how are you going to handle this?
It was a rogue ship.
Good. An unfortunate and regrettable circumstance in any business venture. But part of the whole experience of free trading.
Kang flicked ashes from his cigarette and looked at Kane.
What is your business here?
I'm looking for Ambika.
Why?
To discuss business.
Might I suggest that I could be as helpful to you as she is?
You could, but I'm going to talk to her.
Why then did you come to me?
Christensen said you'd know where she was.
I always know where she is. But I'm not in the habit of performing menial services.
After your ship had gone rogue, I knew there was a chance that you might have heard which ship it had attacked. You might have heard that Christensen picked up someone from Columbine Island. I figured I'd stop in and clear up some of the curiosity you might have before you got too interested in what we're doing here.
A careful man who yet moves boldly. You don't see that combination often. In answer to your question, Ambika has taken rooms upstairs for the day. On the fourth floor. It's where she conducts her business. It's an arrangement we worked out. You'll find her there now.
Then we'll take our leave and go see her.
Of course.
Kang held up an open palm, and Kane knew it was a gesture meant to command the men around him. Kane stubbed out his cigar and slid back his chair to stand. Grant remained sitting.
I'll be along in just a minute. Catch up with you.
Kane knew Grant was going to stay there to cover his back. It saved them both the trouble of growing eyes in the backs of their heads. He nodded at Kang.
In the future, perhaps we might yet get a chance to do business together. You are a most interesting man. And I don't even have your name.
It's Kane.
I'll remember you, Kane.
Guiding Christensen, Kane pushed the other man ahead of him, past another sec man, and up the broad sweeping stairs, curling up to the second floor, to the third floor, and finally to the fourth floor. He paused at the top, went to the railing, and covered Grant, who rose from his place at Kiang's table and followed. Once he reached Kane and Christensen, they moved on. The rooms were as opulent as any Kane had ever seen. There was no mistaking which unit was Ambika's. It was the largest unit, taking up one full side of the building. Guards stood in front of all three doors leading to the suite of rooms. They were dressed in the blue and white colors of her flag, like an honor guard, but it was clear they weren't decoration.
State your business.
Kane glanced at the short line of men and women seated in chairs out in the hallway. Evidently, they were all waiting to have an audience with Ambika. All of them had the look of ship's captains about them, their faces leathery and worn.
We're here to see Ambika.
So are all these people. What's the nature of your business?
Tell her we're from the Utah territories.
A look of surprise flashed across the man's face, but he quickly squelched it.
Wait here.
A quick hand signal drew the attention of the rest of his crew, and they immediately focused on Kane and Grant. The man stepped through the double doors, giving Kane a brief glimpse of the expansiveness of the room inside. He returned mere moments later.
This way.
Kane, Grant, and Christensen fell in behind him, moving easily, aware of the other men flanking them. Surprisingly, no one demanded their weapons. Mbika, or whoever they were going to meet, seemed fully confident of their ability to take care of themselves. The man opened a second set of double doors and gestured them inward. He led the way inside. Kane trailed him, taking in the sitting room at a glance. Doors across the room opened onto a balcony with a small brass telescope on a tripod. A trio of sofas filled the center of the room. Two women waited within at a small bar. The right side held a fireplace, though Kane couldn't see how it would be needed in the gentle climate of the Western Isles. Beside the fireplace were double doors leading to the room everyone outside was waiting to get into. The room impressed Kane. It would have been perfectly appropriate in the upper levels at Cobaltville.
Sit.
Kane and Grant did, sitting on two different sofas facing in different directions with a view of the whole room. Christensen sat in the third sofa. Kane gazed through the window, noting that it afforded a view of the gentle sloping beach leading down to the harbor and the Pacific Ocean beyond. With the telescope, a person would have no problem identifying ships out in the harbor, or people who'd come in on them. After a few minutes, the doors opened, and Mbika strode through. Kane gazed at the woman, feeling the reaction to her femaleness hit him like a 40-pound sledge. He'd talked with Grant, away from Bridget, and listened to his friend's description of the woman, but it hadn't come close to the beauty that she held. Her tight blue leather pants hugged every luscious curve, and a white shirt with belled sleeves and a drawstring front revealed that her breasts were rounded and full, the same dusky complexion as the rest of her. Large nipples pressed firmly against the fabric. A pearl band held her long hair in a tail, with strands of silver crisscrossing through it, further binding it. Her huge Kasul 454 blaster was nestled in a crossdraw holster on the front of her left side. A trio of stilettos on her right thigh didn't escape Kane's trained eye. She wore knee-high black boots that put her an inch or two taller than Kane. She swept into the room, drawing the eye of every man there. She gazed at Kane and Grant, disregarding Christensen almost immediately.
Tell me who you are and why I shouldn't have you chilled this very minute.
My name is Kane. That's Grant. We came here to talk about Cobaltville.
Ambika's servant handed her a glass of wine as she regarded her guests with bright interest. The servant offered them glasses, but they shook their heads no.
It took years after the nuke cost for the grapevines to take hold again, and they had to be carefully imported from France where the nuclear fallout hadn't quite destroyed everything. It took even more years to produce vines that took to the soil and conditions here. We're still not producing enough to export at more than marginal profit, but it will come. In any case, I've heard of you before. Both of you used to be Cobaltville magistrates.
She turned to speak over her shoulder.
McIlwain, take your men and go.
Kane watched the sec chief's face, noting the displeasure the man displayed. Obviously, he wasn't used to being dismissed so cavalierly. Still, he signaled to his men, and they left without a word, closing the double doors behind them.
Do you think me foolish or overly confident for asking them to leave?
Not less confident or foolish than we were, walking into this room to speak with you.
Mbika smiled back at him then, and Kane was surprised to find his reaction coming from two places, his mind and his groin. Part of him couldn't help wondering what she would be like in other circumstances. Her strength was apparent, as well as her dexterity. He had no doubt that she'd be a demanding and challenging partner.
I knew you'd probably come after I was told about the sand cat that had attacked one of Kiang's ships off the coast of Columbine Island.
Who told you?
I have spies in Kiang's organization, just as I have spies within Cobaltville. Baron Cobalt is much more suspicious these days. Over the past year, three of my spies who sometimes worked within the administrative monolith were chilled. The Baron made sure I knew, and sent a message out to everyone else who might consider accepting bribes. But I don't have spies within wherever it is you're from.
No.
Where are you from?
Sorry.
I could make it worth your while.
Tempting, but we have an agenda here.
We? I'm guessing you're talking about more than just the two of you. It has to be a small group. Otherwise, you'd have taken a more aggressive posture with the Barons yourselves. Though I did hear that you were responsible for chilling Baron Ragnar.
Kane didn't bother correcting that misconception.
However, you've obviously got resources I hadn't considered. You found the gateway and got through, while Baron Cobalt couldn't. What do you wish to gain from this meeting?
To find out if we can work together.
What kind of information can you get?
Intel about movement, supplies, personnel. We've been able to get pretty much whatever we wanted.
You believe I need this?
If you don't, then I'm wasting both our times.
He gazed into her electric aqua eyes, noting gleaming lights deep within them. She sipped her wine, taking a moment as she raked him with her eyes, as bold and imperious as any man gawking at a woman.
You're not wasting your time. Meet me at the dock before sunset tonight. We'll be leaving then.
At night?
Ambika flicked her glance over to him.
My captains know these waters well, and the tide is favorable. Tonight, there'll be less traffic, and it's easier to avoid spying eyes. Kang has his own watchers. I'll see you then.
She turned and left the room. Kane watched her go, noting the smooth roll of hips beneath the tight leather pants.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know what you mean.